Good morning. One of the questions we were asked to respond to is, why do we attend Bethel? What brought us to Bethel? We moved to Colorado Springs in January of 1999 after having lived in Pennsylvania for 3.5 years, and before moving to Pennsylvania, we had lived in Craig, Colorado. We were looking to move back to Colorado and needed to move to a larger town than Craig and decided on Colorado Springs. Before we moved to Colorado Springs, we had gotten in touch with Merv Berkey, who was the pastor at Bethel, asking him for information about renting and about churches. We were actually involved in Mennonite Church in Scottsdale, Pennsylvania, and wanted to continue worshiping in a Mennonite church. So it was a natural transition for us to go from Kingview Mennonite in Scottsdale to Bethel in Colorado Springs. We took a big risk moving here with 3 children and no jobs. But looking back, it was a decision I'm glad we made. Bethel has been our church family for 21 years, and we have been abundantly blessed worshiping with all of you. The next 2 stories are ones that I've shared previously, but you're going to hear them again. The first one I call My Timber Bay Fleece. I was working for MCC in northern Saskatchewan as a secretary in a children's home for Native American students. It was a 2-year term, but nearing the end of my term, I felt that I should stay another year. So I did stay. And at the end of my 3rd year, I again had the feeling, the nudging, that I should remain for a 4th year. But I fought against that nudging. I definitely did not want to stay there another year. But yet I had that nudging. So I've never done this before or since. I placed a fleece before God, asking if this nudging was really from Him. And if it was, that He would supply funds for me to purchase a vehicle. And I named a specific amount. The children's home was quite isolated. We were 20 miles from the highway and 75 miles from town. Those of us without vehicles always had to borrow one, and that really became a nuisance. Because I had been doing voluntary service, our funds were just, you know, for necessities. I did not tell anyone what I had prayed. It was between God and myself. When my boss, who was the superintendent of the children's home, asked me if I would be going home after my 4th year, I happily told him, oh yes, I'm going to be going home. My fleece had not been answered. He then went on asking if I would stay if I was placed on a salary. The children's home is owned by the Brethren in Christ Church. He told me how much it would be per month, and when he said the amount, I thought, oh no, because for the year, that salary would be the amount that I had prayed for. I said, no, God, you're not answering this prayer. I don't want to stay. But how could I not? He had answered my prayer. So then I shared my fleece with my boss, and I said, okay, I guess I will be staying another year. And I was able to borrow the money from my dad to purchase the car. And that summer, my Robert's sister and brother-in-law, they worked at the children's home, and she was having her first child. So Robert and son Andrew made the trip to Colorado to be there for her, for the birth. And Robert's parents were also serving at the children's home. His dad was the pastor for this summer. That's how Robert and I met, and we were married a year later. So decisions that we make, whether big or small, everything has a consequence in our decisions, whether they be good, bad, big or small, our decisions do have consequences. The next story is about my dad. Growing up in a home with one parent not a believer, my walk with Jesus was a very important one. My dad had been reared in a Christian home, but he did not have a personal relationship with God. As a child, my main prayer was always that he would turn to Jesus. In later years, I started to wonder, what was it going to take for him to believe? I was beginning to lose hope that he would ever become a believer. How many chances would he be given? He had a slight stroke when he was 60, and two of his brothers had passed away from heart attacks in their 40s. But then a week before he passed away in the hospital, one evening he asked my mom what he had to do to become saved. He quoted John 3:16, which he had learned in his early years growing up in the church. My mom had been praying for him for 62 years. She thought when they got married, he would become a believer. But that didn't happen. People don't change people. Only God can change a person's mind and heart. And while he was in the hospital, we were able to celebrate communion with him, which was a very moving experience. I'd never had communion with my dad, and it was just a very wonderful experience. And for those of you who have family members who aren't believers, don't give up on praying for them, because God is faithful. For me, my dad's coming to belief again was a miracle. Our whole family said, oh, this is a miracle from God. And that can never be taken away from us. And even though he's not with us anymore, I'm going to see him again. And we have that hope because of what Jesus did for us. And it's just, for me, it's exciting. I'm looking forward to seeing him again. And one of my dad's favorite hymns is Rock of Ages. And we're going to sing the first and fourth verse of Rock of Ages together as a congregation.
When I was asked to speak today and then told it would that the verses we would be focusing on were the verses from Genesis, I thought that was kind of irresistible for me, because when I went to Heston College, like some of you might have, there was a biblical literature course that was a real eye-opener, and I don't know if others have that experience, but I think that has been going on for decades now, and it certainly was a milestone for me, even if I had to take it twice. But one of the biggest revelations that I got from it was the idea that the creation story, historically speaking, when scholars look back, there's not really a record of that particular story until our spiritual ancestors were captives in Babylonian in their enslavement. And what I think that indicates is that if that was ever a story that people believed or embraced before that, it may have faded a bit, and there are plenty of creation stories there everywhere, you know, for every culture, and there are all kinds of similarities and differences. And I think that what's assumed to have happened is that when captive, our ancestors re-embraced or adapted or whatever you might say, the garden metaphor, because when they looked around them, they saw that the Babylonians who were oppressing them, sometimes violently, had a story that they subscribed to in which the god Marduk violently slayed a female god, Tiamat, and from the broken pieces of her body came creation. And so there was the idea that before any creation, there has to be a violent confrontation and that one has to overpower another. And I think that idea is seen in plenty of other stories that would have been overlapping or maybe shared in that oral tradition. And sometimes it's simply seen as, or I guess you could say the underlying idea is basically that a powerful god has to slay chaos and create order, that there has to be a conflict, that one has to come out triumphantly and then make order happen and then dominate over that. And so I think what was so exciting and still sort of is to me today is to think that in our modern culture, we're all aware that there's sometimes tension and sometimes argument between what we'd say creationists and then maybe scientists, and just like that it can be a polarizing thing, and that maybe that's not necessary at all. That, this story was embraced at a time when no one was worried about who could empirically prove anything and prove or disprove. And what I guess that means to me is that takes that argument out of our focus and says that the metaphor that we embrace is the garden metaphor, and that can be every bit as real as it was then. It can be that real to us. And then again, to say modern times, and we have such a different perspective that they wouldn't have known to predict, whatever, it didn't matter back then. And we like evidence, we like data, we like all these things to be able to provide security, but maybe that metaphor can be embraced, and it can be seen in contrast maybe to the taming, the conquering, the dominating of anything. And I think we also, if we're invited to be a part of a garden metaphor, if God has planted and God is growing, we can be a part of that. We can also plant. We'll never be the reason anything grows, but we can plant and we can be a part of that creative process, and we can try to facilitate it. And I think we could also say we could step out of the way when the time is right for us to be stepping out of the way of growth that might not be comfortable for us. But we're not asked to, in every case, conquer and dominate and create or maintain order, because that's God's job. And I feel like that's I don't bring up the tension to ruffle any feathers, but I say it because I feel like that's a very encouraging way to see our relationship to God and to each other and ourselves. And I feel like it's a very encouraging way to move forward, because that's what we get to do all the time, is keep moving forward. So I like that we can embrace being part of that creativity.